Good morning. Can you hear me in the back?
Yes.
Okay. I've titled my presentation, Juan Martín de Veramendi, Tejano Political and Business Leader. I'm going to read it because Veramendi is such an interesting subject that I don't want to leave any of it out. Three San Antonio natives born in Spanish Texas attained the office of governor of the Mexican state of Coahuila y Texas. They were Rafael González, Juan José Elguezabal, and Juan Martín de Veramendi. Of these, Veramendi, whose dates are 1788 to 1833, stands out as the only one who rose to power through a lifetime of participation in civil government and business enterprise. González and Elguezabal achieved their status as military men. Unfortunately, Veramendi's tenure as governor was short, lasting less than 1 year during 1833, when he and family members died tragically in a cholera epidemic. The heritage of Juan Martín de Veramendi extends back to the Basque region of Spain, where his father, Fernando, was born in the city of Pamplona around the year 1745. Fernando arrived in San Antonio de Béjar by 1775 and quickly won acceptance by local residents. The next year, he married Maria Josefa Granados, a San Antonio native. Fernando prospered. By 1783, his family lived in a fine stone house located on Soledad Street, and he had purchased 4 tracts of irrigated land. The next year, at the end of April, Veramendi set out for Mexico City in the company of other travelers. Barely a month later, he was killed in an Indian attack near Guerrero, Coahuila. Upon the arrival of the news of his death, the church bell sounded, demonstrating the esteem Bejaraños felt for him. Fernando left behind 3 sons, Jose Maria, Juan Martín del Carmen, the subject of this study, and Fernando Ramón, ages 6, 5, and 1, respectively. A daughter, Maria Josefa, was born posthumously. Veramendi left a detailed will in which he asked parish priest Pedro Fuentes to handle the education of his sons and Juan José de la Santa to manage their business interests. At age 9, Juan Martín's mother died, and he was then raised by his grandmother and a stepfather, Juan Martín Amondarain, a Castilian Spaniard. In his youth, Juan Martín formed lasting friendships with boys who would become Bejaraño leaders, such as Erasmo Seguin, José Francisco Ruiz, and José Ángel Navarro. By age 23, Veramendi attained personal independence and acquired ownership of the Soledad Street house from his siblings. He learned the skills of the merchant trade and began to build upon the successes of his father. Alcalde Ángel Navarro appointed Juan Martín to his first public office of record in 1808. As síndico procurador, Veramendi's responsibility was to enforce council rules, such as those pertaining to public health. Yet he did not let municipal duties get in the way of his merchant activities, for he dedicated 4 months of that year to a mercantile journey. By that time, at age 30, Veramendi was an experienced merchant. He knew how to obtain marketable goods, and he knew the trade routes between Béjar and Nacogdoches. In March 1808, he assembled 14 mule loads of goods to take to the military settlement of Trinidad de Salcedo on the Trinity River and to Nacogdoches. Among his personal possessions were some, quote, small gold items. He did not complete the trip to Nacogdoches, however. The military commandant there reported his failure to arrive. When questioned about his tardy return to Béjar, Veramendi said that because of an intermittent fever, he remained many days in the vicinity of Trinidad de Salcedo and the nearby Bernin Ranch. Perhaps so, but one wonders whether Veramendi's trip may have combined legal and contraband trade, which was common along the southeastern area of Texas. With his small gold items, he could have easily bought a stash of goods from Louisiana traders, such as tobacco and cloth, for which there was always a market in San Antonio. In addition to his merchant activities, Juan Martín operated a ranch called San José, located on Cibolo Creek southeast of San Antonio. In 1810, he reported 470 head of cattle, and his 2,142 head of sheep and goats nearly double those of any other rancher. The Viramundi sheep produced large amounts of wool for export. That same year, he married 18-year-old Maria Josefa Navarro, younger sister of his friend and neighbor, Jose Angel. As a result of his marriage, Viramundi joined the Navarro and Ruiz families. Bound by kinship, marriage, shared political values, and economic ideals, this formidable family clan exerted a powerful influence on public affairs. By the end of the year, Juan Martín de Viramundi, at age 32, had all the trappings of success, material, political, and social, and he had matched the accomplishments of his father. But a crushing attack on royal authority began in the summer of 1812. Jose Bernardo Gutierrez de Lara and Augustus McGee led a force of volunteers across the Sabine River. Near Nacogdoches, this self-styled Republican Army of the North encountered Viramundi and Juan Manuel Zambrano, both of whom were bringing large amounts of wool. A confrontation ensued between the Republicans and these two notable royalists. As a result, Viramundi and Zambrano lost their wool and mules. Viramundi continued to Nacogdoches and remained there pending the outcome of the Gutierrez-McGee invasion. Viramundi was no stranger to Nacogdoches. Records show that he had loaned money to various individuals there, including 416 pesos to a Mr. Lafitte. Gutierrez and McGee rode south, captured La Bahia, and then San Antonio. Juan Martín's brother-in-law, Jose Antonio Navarro, recorded a vivid account of the brutal execution of Governor Manuel Salcedo and his officers. Retribution for the killing of Salcedo was not long in coming. In Monterrey, Commandant General Joaquín de Arredondo organized a powerful army and marched north. On the morning of Wednesday, August 18th, 1813, he met the Republican Army of the North and engaged it in a battle that ranged along the Medina River. By afternoon, Arredondo's well-trained troops had routed the undisciplined opposition. In San Antonio, rebel property was confiscated, including the Viramundi house, which was rented to two army officers. In October, General Arredondo issued a general pardon and amnesty for rebels that were in Louisiana, with certain exceptions for the principal leaders, among whom were listed Juan Martín de Viramundi and Francisco Ruiz, who were, quote, unworthy of receiving any consideration, whatever. The general offered a 250 peso reward to anyone who killed Viramundi, Ruiz, or other principal revolutionaries, and double the reward for any foreigner who killed them. Despite his unpardonable status of the previous year, by March 1814, Viramundi managed to secure in Nacogdoches a pardon for himself and his brother Fernando, with the provision that they should be kept under surveillance as being dangerous to the public tranquility. The Viramundi brothers retained at Béjar around the end of the year. Juan Martín set about to regain possession of his house and to clear his reputation. He gained permission for an audience with Commandant General Arredondo. Showing political skills that would later make him a governor, Viramundi met with the Commandant in Monterrey and achieved total vindication. He returned triumphantly with an order from Arredondo that stunned the governor and the two officers that were renting his house. They were ordered to return the house and to dismiss the charges that Viramundi had adhered to the Revolutionary Party. Moreover, that as a good patriot, he was not to be further molested in person or property. In 1820, Viramundi was again elected to the city council, this time as a councilman. This was a landmark election, the first held under the articles of the recently reinstated Spanish Constitution of 1812. The introduction of the 1812 Constitution marked the rapid transition from Spanish rule to Mexican independence. And the next year, Governor Antonio Martinez led Bejarreños in an oath of allegiance to the Plan de Iguala, which called for an independent Mexico organized as a constitutional monarchy. Under the new political order, a main concern of Bejarreños was to achieve a goal that had been desired and denied since the early settlement of Texas, which was the establishment of a port, which was authorized in 1820. The next year, the city council designated La Bahia to be a port of entry and named Viramundi to be the collector of import taxes for goods bought primarily from New Orleans. The imports increased rapidly, being distributed not only in Texas, but in shipments to Coahuila and Nuevo León. Import duties provided substantial income for the treasuries of Béjar, Saltillo, and San Luis Potosí. Veramendi's report of July 1822, showing a total of 727 pesos collected, demonstrates the scale of the import income. In the summer of 1824, negotiations in Mexico City resulted in Texas and Coahuila being joined into one state. Within 3 months, by decrees at the national and local level, Texas lost all its political autonomy, a traumatic development for Tejanos. Between 1824 and 1827, political leaders wrote a colonization plan and a constitution that provided a political foundation for the new state. Saltillo was designated as the capital, a decision that greatly displeased the people of Monclova, whose city had been the capital since the earliest days. During this period of state building, the work of municipal government never stopped, and Veramendi was to serve twice as San Antonio's alcalde during two political transitions. Electors selected him as alcalde for the year 1825, the first operational year of the state. Upon assuming office, Veramendi immediately faced heated disputes over the ownership of property confiscated in 1813. Decrees of 1821 and 1822 provided a legal basis under certain conditions for the return of confiscated property to the original owners. Many claims resulted, and Veramendi faced the wrath and ridicule of irate parties. In June, however, he reported that all the disputes had been resolved except one. Upon leaving office at the end of 1825, Veramendi dedicated himself to his merchant career. He also began the process of acquiring land. In the summer of 1827, he applied for an 11-league grant, 40,000 plus acres, in the Green DeWitt Colony, which was approved. But Bejaraños kept him in mind for public service. In May 1827, the council elected him as a supplemental legislator in case a substitute were needed to replace either Miguel Arciniega or Jose Antonio Navarro, who were Texas representatives in the first state Congress. San Antonio leaders must have been impressed with Veramendi's previous performance as alcalde, for they reelected him for the year 1828. Juan Martín, however, wanted nothing more to do with the squabbles of local government and firmly rejected the appointment. He appealed to the political chief and to the governor, saying that his office as supplemental legislator prevented him from serving and requested that his election be annulled. To Veramendi's dismay, Governor Viesca ruled against him, saying that having been elected, he must serve. Thus, the reluctant Veramendi served another term and was the first alcalde to serve in the articles of the new state constitution. Meanwhile, the first state Congress ended its term in September. The Tejano representatives firmly supported the last decree passed, number 64, which declared Monclova to be the state capital. That transfer, however, would not be effected for 4 years until after Veramendi became governor. He completed his second term as alcalde at the end of 1828 and was freed from what evidently was the onerous chores of local government leadership. During the next 2 years, he pursued merchant efforts. The Bejaraños, however, had yet another political role for Veramendi. In 1830, they sent his nomination for him as vice governor to the Saltillo legislature. The legislature, composed of 8 members, met on January 3, 1831, and first elected Jose Maria Letona as governor. For vice governor, a runoff between Veramendi and Ignacio de Arispe was held. When the ballots were counted, Veramendi won by unanimous vote. No evidence was found of his being sworn in during that legislative session. Thus, he probably remained in Béjar to tend to his mercantile business and other interests. A few months before, James Bowie arrived. Already a legend in Louisiana, Bowie crossed into Texas in February 1830 with the intent of becoming a citizen and seeking his fortune. In San Antonio, Bowie met Veramendi, and they evidently sized each other up as influential men who could work together toward mutual interests. Bowie became enamored with Veramendi's daughter, Ursula. Seeking to gain both a desirable mate and entrance into a respected, influential family, he proposed marriage. On April 25, 1831, Bowie and Ursula married in what was said to have been the most elaborate social event in years. Juan Martín traveled to Gonzales in the fall of 1831 to begin the final process of gaining title to 5 of the 11 leagues of land conceded to him in 1827. Land Commissioner José Antonio Navarro awarded him possession of the land on springs that were tributaries of the Guadalupe River, 3 leagues on the present Comal Springs and New Braunfels, and 2 leagues on the San Marcos Springs, where we are today. Veramendi intended to take his remaining 6 leagues at a site near Refugio Mission, but he died before being able to obtain title to them. Governor Letano died in September 1832. 2 months later, the legislature sent for Veramendi to come to Saltillo and take charge of the state government. On January 1, 1833, Veramendi addressed the legislature. His presentation was optimistic, and he spoke in upbeat generalities, but also noted the serious difficulties that the state and the nation faced. Veramendi came into office in a legislative environment that was decidedly favorable to Texas, one supported by a majority block of representatives from Monclova and Parras. During March, the legislature took under consideration petitions from San Antonio, Goliad, and Parras to move the capital from Saltillo to Monclova. The assembly voted, and the measure passed with a vote of 7-3, the 3 Saltillo members voting against it. Veramendi signed the measure into law on March 9th as Decree number 214. On April the 1st, the Monclova State Legislature held its first session. The first 4 months were concerned mostly with routine issues. By summer, however, a fearful threat of cholera had arrived in Coahuila, and concern about its spread was acute. On August 13th, Veramendi sent an order to the political chief of Saltillo to put into effect a plan to quarantine persons who developed cholera symptoms. If the jail was filled, he ordered the official to expropriate individual houses in which to place and contain the sick. Symptoms of cholera, a waterborne disease, soon appeared in Monclova. For hundreds, death was imminent. Infected water somehow entered the upper reaches of the acequia that provided much of the town's water supply. During the early days of September, the Veramendi family fell ill and died at the height of the epidemic. The first was Maria Josefa Navarro, Veramendi's wife. The governor, at age 55, expired at 6 o'clock in the morning of the 7th. The dead totaled nearly 500 and were buried in great haste. The Veramendis, like hundreds of others, were interred in a mass grave in the Pantheon of the Royal Hospital. News of Veramendi's death arrived in San Antonio by September 26, and the church bells tolled for him as they had for his father 50 years before. The material legacy of Veramendi was huge. The estate inventories filled nearly 200 pages. The net value of his property totaled more than 30,000 pesos to be distributed among 8 minor heirs that had remained in Béjar. Veramendi left a legacy of confidence to his fellow Tejanos, the affirmation that leaders among them had the capacity to serve at the highest level of government and to excel in business. But his place in history has not survived without reproach and censure. The life of Veramendi has come down to us in a highly abbreviated form, one that is unfortunately firmly joined with and subordinated to the life and legends of James Bowie. As a result, Bowie's connection with Veramendi produced erroneous accounts that came to be accepted by influential historians. Vito Alessio Robles' 3-volume work of the history of Coahuila y Texas is a monumental accomplishment, one indispensable for a comprehensive understanding of Texas history. However, he took a jaundiced view of Veramendi, in part because of his in-law relationship with Bowie. Alessio Robles concluded that Veramendi's vice governorship was a creation of Anglo-American colonists and that he was little more than a tool serving their interests. In addition, he concluded that it was James Bowie who influenced state legislators to approve the transfer of the state capital from Saltillo to Monclova. Alessio Robles' interpretation of Veramendi and Bowie is seriously flawed. because he relied solely on the memoirs of Antonio Menchaca to support his conclusions. Menchaca's memoirs are certainly a valuable historical source, but they should be used with caution and with cooperation in this case, since he dictated his recollections about Veramente and Bui more than 30 years after the fact. Information gained in this study does not support the Alessio Robles Menchaca assessment regarding Veramente and Bui. Regarding the first allegation, that Anglos engineered Veramente's vice governorship for their purposes. As noted above, the 1831 legislature elected him by unanimous vote. While Anglo-Americans could have influenced the Bejaranos' nomination of Veramente, they could hardly have determined the legislator's decisive vote in Saltillo. Regarding moving the capital from Saltillo to Monclova, at best, Menchaca greatly exaggerated Bui's role. As noted above, Bejarano legislators supported the move to Monclova beginning in 1828. Then in 1833, with their own Juan Martín de Veramente as governor, supported by a favorable legislature, they were positioned to accomplish that long-sought goal. The Monclova and Paris legislators did not need James Bui to influence them. They already wanted the capital moved to advance their own interests. In conclusion, there's no reason to doubt that Juan Martín de Veramente's primary allegiance was to his fellow Tejanos. The allegation that he was an instrument of Anglo-Americans has no foundation other than presumptions based on his associations with James Bui. In addition, moving the capital to Monclova should be credited not to James Bui, but rather to the efforts of Juan Martín de Veramente, his fellow Tejanos, and members of the Fourth Legislature.